Listen.
Послушай.
Écoute.
Помогите,
ください. Escucha. MCO.
Listen.
MCO.
MCO.
Between the Bars.
Hi, my name is Yannick Dondelanger. Welcome to Between the Bars, the podcast where life and music mingle in conversations with the people who shape and who are the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. The violinist Kirsty Hilton and the trombonist Mark Hampson both had no idea when they left their native countries in the 1990s that they would eventually help to shape and define one of the world's finest orchestras. Their musical emigration in their tender 20s took them from carefree teenagehood in sunny Sydney to poverty student life in London, big career breaks in Germany, to work in Spain and China, and finally into what became the musical, social family that is the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. Kirsty, while living in Germany, became so homesick for her native Australia that one cold Bavarian winter, this is what she did.
Once I remember putting sun cream on inside the house just to have the smell of summer.
And Mark, while describing the air in Shuzhou, China, gave me a rundown of what an AQI index is and why he had to check it every single day.
Yeah, well, it's amazing because I didn't even know what an AQI, you know, was. Suddenly it becomes a thing you look at every single morning before the weather, before anything.
I joined them both in Adelaide, Australia, where we were performing at the Adelaide Festival. We enjoyed some local red wine with our chat. I could recommend you also do the same while you're listening. And if you stay right to the end, you'll find out something quite remarkable that connects Australia and three particular pieces written by the composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
All right, I want to say welcome to MCO's very first podcast. Today, I've got two MCO musician members, Mark Hampson, trombone, Kirsty Hilton, violin. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us in Adelaide, Adelaide, Australia. We're playing at the Adelaide Festival here, rehearsing as well. So we're here for around 4 or 5 days, I think, or 6 days.
Yeah, almost a week, I think. Yeah.
Almost a week, yeah. It's like, is it 4 days of rehearsal?
Yeah. Three concerts.
Three concerts.
It's quite intense, yeah.
Very intense. And then we fly, I don't know, a few thousand kilometres up to Japan. Yeah. And then we finish in Shanghai. There's a small theme going here for this podcast, musical emigration. Very, very special for you two because you spent many years outside of your home countries. So I want to start with you, Kirsty. You are from Australia, from Sydney.
Yes, from Sydney.
First of all, what's it like playing here in your home country anyway?
It's great. I mean, this is the first time I'm the only one without jet lag arriving at the beginning of a tour. Everyone knows how I normally feel. And yeah, so we have been to Australia once before with MCO to Sydney and Melbourne. But yeah, just to be in Australia, this is probably the most prestigious festival in Australia, I think, Adelaide Festival. It's actually called the Festival State, South Australia is.
Right.
So they're very proud of this festival and it's probably one of the oldest festivals. I don't know that exactly, but it's definitely the most famous one and people travel from all over Australia to come to it.
I didn't realize how huge it was.
It is very big.
I mean, walking around, and when you look at read the program, it's massive.
So, yeah, it's great to be part of that. I actually haven't ever played in the festival before, so it's exciting.
Of course, you're from Australia, but you have spent many years in another country.
Exactly.
And that's what I want to get on to. Let's talk a bit about your history. You obviously grew up in Australia, in Sydney.
In Sydney, yeah.
But at some point, you studied music, but at some point you disappeared off to Europe.
Exactly.
How did that come about? What was?
Well, most Australians go and study abroad at one point. Just we feel very isolated here because the music world is just very small.
Yes.
It's a very high level in Australia, but yeah, you do just feel very far away. And there's so few orchestras for a career as well. I mean, there's only six orchestras in Australia or something like that, seven maybe. I actually went straight into Australian Chamber Orchestra from school and just thought, because I was so young then, 18, that I needed to do something else. So, yeah, in 1998, I went to London first for a year to study.
Right. So were you at Guildhall?
I was at Guildhall, yeah, right, okay. Doing the advanced solo studies, which was great, but I actually didn't have any money to stay longer than a year. I had no working visa there. I couldn't do any work as a musician, so I was doing babysitting and things, but my scholarship money was just going down quickly in London. So basically I wanted to go to Germany after that because I knew it was free to study.
Yeah, and that's a big point, isn't it? That mm-hmm. I mean, basically the course costs hardly anything.
Yeah.
And if, for example, if you're in a city like Berlin, it's, you know, much cheaper to live
exactly.
in London.
Yeah.
Especially back then. Yeah. I mean, the difference was really marked.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I auditioned for Carry-On Academy, which I knew about from being in Australia, actually, through the youth orchestra. We'd had several chamber music courses with members of the Berlin Phil.
And the Carry-On Academy, that's the official orchestra academy of the Berlin Philharmonic.
Exactly, training academy. And I'd visited Berlin a few times and loved it. And then I was lucky enough to get into Carry-On Academy. And then that's when I ended up staying in Germany for 10 years.
We're going to get onto your, professional years in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But first I want to ask, Mark, your journey to Germany. Now, Kirsty, you said how you made your way via England to Germany. How did you, what was the catalyst for you? Because you're English, I should say.
Yeah.
Born and bred.
Born and bred, absolutely.
And, of course, you did a large part of your studies in England, London?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate at the Guildhall, so I was there for 4 years.
Do you know what you realise? That means all three of us were at Guildhall.
Well, really? Yeah, we were there, I think, at the same time.
Were we there at the same time?
Yeah. But you don't remember.
I don't know. We are talking early 90s.
91 to 95 I was then.
I was 98.
Yeah. You were a little later. But, you know, I did my postgraduate in Mannheim. But it was kind of the opposite thing. I encountered quite a lot of resistance in London to studying elsewhere.
Well, why did you decide to, because it is a different school, especially for brass players. Why did you decide to go flavor the German brass school?
I can say that it's because of that I really wanted to broaden myself and all these, you know, great reasons. But actually it was money. Again, it was just that.
Cheaper to study.
Much cheaper. And I had a DARD scholarship. This sort of exchange service. It comes from the German government, but for foreign students.
German government paid you.
Yeah,
and
it was an
there.
Amazing scholarship. I mean, they cover travel, living costs, obviously fees.
Right.
So this was something that I just couldn't get in London. And as Kirsty says, you know, I mean, in London, for any student is a challenge, you know, from the point of view of living there and costs. So for me, it was kind of a no-brainer, really.
Right.
But I encountered a lot of resistance, from my old professors. And
in what way? In sort of why do it? What's the point? We're the center of the universe, or
yeah, I think it's a bit of a British phenomena, you know, that particularly London centric, you know, that's the place to be, and there are wonderful things going on there, of course.
Okay, so you both moved on to Germany. Kirsty, if I'm thinking of the situation you were able to have, and you joined the Carry-On Academy, the Academy of the Berlin Philharmonic. From what I understand, you're almost playing in that ensemble every week.
Yeah.
Near enough.
I think I did play every week through pretty much.
For
in
like
my
2 years.
Yeah.
Amazing concerts, amazing repertoire. It's, it's a scarily impressive experience.
Yeah. I was very lucky. It was amazing. Before I went there, I'd never played a Mahler symphony or a Bruckner symphony.
Right.
And then I did them all for the first time with Claudio, or Bruckner with Günter Wandt. I remember the first time, one of my first weeks, we did Beethoven triple with Barenboim, Perlman and Yo-Yo Ma. And that was for me just like, I couldn't believe that these three people were on stage at the same time.
Weren't you terrified? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I was only 20 actually, so I think I was still a bit naive, and, you know, things get harder later. So I didn't think about it as much as I would overanalyze things now. Yeah. So, yeah, I just enjoyed it.
I guess it's also the first time you come into contact with that kind of charisma, you know. I mean, you know, when you see, because of course you can see someone on a video or hear them on a recording, but then when you're on stage and you experience, and these guys do have amazing charisma, don't they? And
exactly.
It's something you... It's really tangible.
I think what I realized was the importance of a conductor as well. You know, before that,
it's just not
just thinking,
keeping time.
Yeah,
but it's a real question that people often ask. Like, what? And that's
exactly.
when you feel actually what it is.
Yeah, and just that difference in the concert of the inspiration that comes that makes the difference from what you've rehearsed, you know?
That's such a powerful word, charisma, isn't it? And
yeah.
It's something that you can't quantify.
No.
And you sort of, if you happen to join a more regular orchestra and your life becomes more routine, and then one day someone special comes along again and you realize, that's what it was about.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was that word, charisma. And that person with charisma doesn't even need to say, you know, three sentences.
No.
And you're doing it. You're there.
Yeah, they can even be technically not the greatest conductor. No.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter, you know, in that situation.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So you've done the Carrion Academy. As if that wasn't enough, you then suddenly got, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, you got no less than two jobs in two of the best orchestras in the world.
In 2 days.
In 2 days?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Well, yeah, in Munich. So I...
Munich, BR?
Munich Philharmonic one day,
yes.
And then BR the next day.
Explain, for those who are not, for those who don't know what BR is.
Bayerischer Rundfunk.
So the radio orchestra.
The radio orchestra, right. Of Bayerischer.
And these are not any two orchestras.
No, they're good orchestras. I mean, I guess that was one thing from Carrion Academy. There was quite a lot of pressure that you get a good job out of it, you know, even what you applied for. So I'd done one in Munich Phil actually before that I didn't get. That was my first audition. And then, I did that and I got that. And then Bayerischer Rundfunk was, I don't know, I wanted to go there. So I still did the audition the next day and ended up getting that. Yeah, I don't know if they knew I'd just got the job in Munich Film. Maybe that's why they wanted me.
And also, I mean, also doing an audition, it's not, it's easier said than done. I mean, just in a couple of sentences, what is it? Tips from the top. What is the key? If you're going to nail that.
Well, I think the main thing I learned, I remember Guy Brownstein telling me, the person who wins the job is not necessarily who plays the best on the day, it's who gives the most on the day. And in an audition, I find it easier than a concert in a way because, you know, it's a short amount of time actually, so less time you have to concentrate. But you have to, in that short space of time, really show something special. So when I was practicing Mozart concerto or something, that in the first few lines you're showing something different from everybody else.
Different musically?
Musically, yeah.
Technique is taken for granted. But you have to show your personality, your own charisma.
Yeah, and I'd spent hours and hours like on the opening two lines of the Mozart concerto and just that it was 150% secure.
Right.
And... yeah, so I just sort of had a way of practicing that I...
But you mean so that it was 100% technically secure so that you could express yourself over
myself
the top of that?
And exaggerating everything in it, exactly. Right. So Guy also had me always playing, he said, do it till you feel it's ridiculous, you know, because it doesn't come across. You know, often Berlin Phil don't have a screen, but a lot of orchestras do. And all of that, those little details don't come through, actually, unless you really exaggerate. So... yeah, I guess it was playing in a different way from how I'd perform it in a concert.
Mark, can I ask you, was your first job in Germany? Did you continue in Germany after your studies? Did you come back to England?
No, I didn't. I had a sort of a two-year contract in a German opera house in Mannheim.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually get the fixed job there. So you can say, like, parallel to my studies, I was working and doing a lot of opera and stuff like that. But my first job that was... actually, my job was Gran Canaria, where I still am.
Can we let's talk about that now? Because now for those who are listening, now you've been in Germany and now you've moved to Spain. Spain is where you're establishing your professional career. Mm-hmm. And as you said, as I think I read in your notes, the polar opposites of Europe.
Yeah.
Describe that culturally, musically, the food.
Yeah, in every way, every possible way, and I mean the Canaries it's a special place because it's a kind of a midway between Europe and South America, so it's even between the Spanish Sea it as being quite Latino, you know, so sort of towards Cuba and Venezuela.
Latino in the way of I don't know, partying, staying up later, even later than in Spain.
I don't know about that, but yeah, we certainly, I mean, there's big carnival culture there and certainly the first sort of 2 years I was there, I didn't see many Sundays.
You didn't play in many concerts on Sunday?
No, never. I mean, for obvious reasons.
But, as a musician, difference as a musician, I mean, you're saying hierarchically, what is it? You said, as a musician in England, a more flat hierarchy.
Yeah.
Germany, more hierarchical. China, which we'll get onto in a minute, because you also lived in China, extreme hierarchy. And then Spain, a mess.
I don't know if I should really put it like that. That's maybe not.
Okay, we can strike that.
Maybe in private. Yeah, I mean, it's basically, I think if you're used to the German sort of culture where things tend to be organized and in general work quite well, then when I moved somewhere like that, it took me about 3 years to slow down and just to accept that, for example, if you go and do some piece of paperwork in a government office, then you have to accept you will have to go there 3 or 4 times.
Wow.
Because you won't have, whatever you do, you won't have the right papers. Something will be missing.
Yeah.
Or something will have changed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's in order, you have to actually slow yourself down and relax into things there. Yeah. If you're going to enjoy, you know, your time there.
Was there something you felt in Spain that you couldn't have in Germany, or a way that you could experience your music, even if it's just a way, I can relax more, so I find I'm freer to do different things with my music?
That's the main point. I think Germany is an amazing country. I mean, of course, it's a great country to live and work as a musician. That's clear. But my experience was that when I was studying there and playing in the, you know, on this contract, there's a very particular way of doing things, and that's the way to do it.
Right.
And there's not much flexibility, which is very good for studying because you learn a concept and you learn a way of doing things.
Yeah.
But then when I moved across to Spain, suddenly I found myself in a place where there isn't really an accepted way of doing things, and you're quite free to develop the way you play how you want.
Did you ever have the impression maybe conductors who came there enjoyed that aspect, or they felt, mould the interpretation more? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's an orchestra that's quite open-minded and fairly sort of blank canvas, you know.
And tell us again which orchestra exactly. It's in the Canaries, it's the...
Grand Canary Philharmonic, yeah,
right.
Yeah. I feel that in Australia a bit too, I have to say.
I can imagine it's a similar thing.
And we have people, I remember Nigel Kennedy saying to us that he liked coming when there's not... You know, because we don't have a huge tradition because we're so young, the orchestra, that he can then be not set in our ways, and this is the way we do it, and you can actually do more sometimes.
It's amazing. Yeah. I often feel that with MCO as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Being a young ensemble,
travels
such a lot. You, so many influences.
Yeah.
I mean, you have your traditions, but they always have to be flexible, intelligent traditions. Yeah. Kirsty, but you didn't stay in Germany.
I mean, hang on.
You'd been to maybe the best orchestral academy in the world. You joined two of the best I remember when you first started playing in MCO around 2000, very near the beginning.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember when I first met you, I think it was at Festival Aix-en-Provence was one of the first times we worked together. We had to do some chamber music together. We didn't have to. I mean, it was great. We did. I was in Mozart Horn Quintet.
Horn Quintet.
You probably don't remember it.
I do remember.
I was terrified. You terrified.
What?
No, really. All I knew was that this girl had come from Karajan Academy, you know, and I think, I don't even know whether you'd got your jobs yet in Munich.
No, I don't. I think I was still in Berlin at that time, yeah.
Intimidating person you are.
Really? Yeah.
It was very good for me. But then, years later... Okay, what happens then? You leave Germany.
Yeah, I mean, I had a great time in Germany, so it's not that I hated my time there or anything, not at all. I was happy in Munich, loved the orchestra, loved the job. But I knew I didn't want to stay there forever. I didn't want to end up retiring in Bavaria. For me, the mentality
I didn't want to retire.
I think it's just, it's such a different mentality. It is a beautiful city. But when you're not from there, I mean, one of the main things for me is the weather. I'm really fixated on weather.
but they have amazing summers and amazing winters in Bavaria.
Well,
I mean, you got the snow.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ski or anything, so something like that I don't really appreciate. And the summers, it's beautiful, but it's such a short time. You know, if it was 6 months, it'd be okay, but it's not. It's three maybe that's decent. And I would get actually quite depressed in the winter. I mean, not depressed, but I remember putting sun cream on inside the house just to have the smell of summer to remember.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember everyone said, okay, it's time to go home, Kirsty.
That's a little bit sad, but I understand the point.
I'm curious, but just to ask you something, because I mean, I guess you've been back here for quite a while now, but what I've found, I mean, I've been away now for 24 years from England, but I look back at England with sort of nostalgia and great affection.
Yeah.
But when I get back there, I realize that I'm actually not that English anymore.
Right.
And it's quite challenging then to be there. You know, I don't. Yeah. I guess you've been back here for a while
I've
now.
Been, yeah.
Was it like that at the beginning, or?
I mean, I always felt very at home in Australia immediately. Yeah. But yeah, there's certain things I remember when I first moved back, just trying to get an apartment and things, and I didn't have a utilities bill or anything to show. You know, I was like a complete alien then. Yeah. You know, then feel like a foreigner. And I had been 10 years in Germany, which is a long time, and also the years between 20 and 30. You know, you change a lot in that time. So, but I always felt Australian, I think.
So you went back to live in the awful city of Sydney.
Exactly.
With that terrible nature and view. And
it's awful. I mean, it's pretty amazing, Sydney. I just love it. And, yeah, I lived right on the water for about nearly 10 years.
But what was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, the dilemma wasn't over.
No, and it took me a long time, actually, to feel settled in the job, and just had I made a big mistake, because I mean, Bayer Schoenfunk is one of the top orchestras in the world, and yeah, I especially loved working with Marius Janssens, who's still chief there. I love him.
Right. You have to get him to come to Sydney Symphony.
Yeah, I know. I've tried. He's, you know, he's getting old, and that's the problem in Australia. We're just so far away. It's hard to get people. And also they nearly need to have 2 weeks free, because coming with the arrival, just the time it takes to get there and back, you know, it doesn't, you can't even have just 1 week free to fit it in. So the big people who are busy, it's very, very difficult.
Should we start talking about jet lag?
Well, yeah.
How are your jet lags, by the way?
Well, I don't have it.
Are you there?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have
Good question.
Yeah.
This is the one occasion where you don't have it on an MCO tour.
I know. It's amazing.
And you're back in Europe how often each year?
About 4 or 5 times a year. I tried to do the longer projects with MCO.
For Mahler Chamber Orchestra, of course.
Yeah, for Mahler Chamber.
And you found a balance, you think?
I think so. I mean, yeah, it's sort of like the flying less and less as I get older, I have to admit.
Yeah,
but then you think, look, it's just a day of your life, you know? and then once I'm there, I love it, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes when I am in Sydney, I think, oh, you know, to have to get on the flight again and things. And then I'm there and I'm planning in when the next trip is. And
I don't think that's necessarily even the long-haul flying. I mean, I feel that just when I have to leave home and go.
Exactly.
50-minute flight into Europe or something.
Yeah. So for me, it is perfect. Yeah, so for a long time, I wondered if I'd done the right thing, and I did go back and do a 6-month contract in Munich. And
oh, right. So you really
yeah,
thought about stepping back into the German work scene.
Yeah. Not that I was unhappy in Sydney, but just, yeah, torn, I guess.
Yeah.
I read a book, I remember, called Leaving Paradise by an Australian author who, she wasn't a musician, but just had lived in Amsterdam for a long time. And then moving back, and just the whole thing that after a certain amount of time, you are always torn between the, because it is still home.
Uh-huh.
There's something, you know, because 10 years is a long time, especially those years where you, you know, become an adult and everything. And
so did you feel you really had a foot in two different cultures?
I did in the beginning, yeah.
And always will, or?
I think I always will, like while
will
I'm
ever
still
give
going.
One up? Or is it that stage in your life? For me, it's a stage where I couldn't possibly imagine giving up Mahler Chamber Orchestra. And I know, like we all do, all the negatives.
Yeah.
But it'll probably be there for the rest of my career.
Yeah, exactly.
Now.
I mean, I don't want to give it up. The only reason I would give it up is just if I had to, you know, and if, I mean, Sydney is my full-time job. And but they're very good with me, with letting me do things
good.
At
so
the moment.
They should be.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's all working out. But no, I wouldn't want to, but give it up.
Right.
But yeah, let's see.
See how it goes.
Happens. Yeah.
Listen, we're gonna take a little break now. The podcast will continue with other tasty things, and we're gonna come back in a second.
Ah, the truly iconic opening of Mozart's 40th symphony, a sound sketch that has become part of the fabric of human history and on this recording, one of MCO's own performances with conductor Daniel Harding. While Kirsty and Mark top up their glasses with more Australian red, and I go look up who wrote the book Leaving Paradise, take a listen to the first of, I hope, many Matty moments. Matthias Meyer, our talented stage manager, takes the microphone outdoors and, in his first encounter, chats to someone who is intimate with some completely different performers who've also flown across the globe to give pleasure to audiences here in Adelaide.
Hey, I'm Matti, and I'm used to be tired. As the stage manager of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, I'm the first to arrive at the concert hall and the last one who leaves. So being tired on tour is quite a normal thing for me. But this time, it was different. Imagine tour life. You finish a concert late at night, and early next morning you are already sitting in a bumpy bus or a train or an airplane on the way to the next venue. You play another concert, and the next morning, the same again. And again. And again. For the next 2 weeks. And then there are tours where it's hard to even start fresh. I'm talking about these journeys that bring you far away from home, where clocks tick different. Changing time zones usually brings a special guest on tour. Hello, jet lag. Jet lag is not a joke, especially when you have to follow a working schedule. So there we were in Adelaide, and this time jet lag hit us really hard. Going to South Australia basically meant going to the other side of the world. Adelaide is 7.5 hours ahead of my hometown in Europe. That's a lot. And even after 4 days, I was still running around like a sleepwalker. I decided to get some help. There must be a better way to deal with jet lag. And as I kept thinking, who's an expert on frequent flying? Who shares that crazy travel life with us? It came to me. Yes, birds. Being the prototype of a frequent flyer, I wanted to talk to them, or at least to someone who knows all about them. And that's how I met Kate. So you're a bird expert, is that right?
Well, I'm a bird lover. I don't know if I'm an expert. I know quite a bit, but I wouldn't like the label expert. But I'm the secretary of Birds SA, and I love birds very much.
Birds SA stands for Birds South Australia. It's the oldest ornithological society of the country, founded in Adelaide over 100 years ago. They have nearly 1,000 members, and besides conservation work and research, they organize monthly bird watching trips open for everyone. Kate was not always a passionate bird lover. She recalls a single moment back in 2003 that drew her into bird watching.
I went to Broome up in Western Australia on holidays, and I booked a tour with a bird person. And I booked that tour simply because I wanted to go camping in the Kimberley. And he had a telescope and put it up on a bird. It was a bird that lives along the shoreline and in water. It's called a pied stilt. And I just couldn't believe these long pink legs.
In our conversation about birds, Kate drew a funny connection.
Many Australian birds, they dress in black and white, and many of them can sing. So they make beautiful music just like you.
Hang on. Dressed in black and white and making beautiful sound? That reminds me of someone. And there are more similarities. Just like us, some birds travel really far. We all heard about migratory birds that spend the summer breeding in the north and then travel for the winter times to the warm south. But how far do they fly? Can they compete with our journey from Europe to Australia?
You've travelled 16,000 kilometres. They travel further than you. They travel 20,000 kilometres in one season. And you do it in an aeroplane, sitting in a seat, they fly.
20,000 kilometres. That's an impressive number. Time for my big question. I wanted to know from Kate How do these birds handle the enormous effort of such a long journey? How do they cope with jet lag?
First of all, they cope better than you in that they feed up. They increase their body weight between 50 and 70%. So looking at you, you need another 50% to cope better.
Well, that's not really an option for us. Imagine the whole orchestra putting on another 50% of their body weight before going on tour. Super size me. We'd need at least 2 seats in the plane for each player, and we would maybe even be way too heavy to travel all together in one plane. But then Kate came up with something really stunning.
They have discovered that these birds have a trait that no humans have. They can close one eye and shut off half their brain and sleep on one side of their body and fly with the other and then swap over. So when you've learnt that technique, you will cope with jet lag.
Wow. That sounds like fiction, right? I mean, birds have there some super skills that I was not aware of. Let's have a look on another issue with traveling long distance. We as an orchestra are aware that flying has an impact on the environment. But what about birds? What's their carbon footprint?
Very limited, because they eat what's in the mud, and what they deposit back in the mud is useful. They clean out their system every 2 minutes, so it's a very quick cycle. But their carbon footprint is nothing, really. I mean, they're just very gentle on the environment.
If you sum it up, birds are the smarter travelers. Facing climate change, the discussion about the environmental impact of traveling is coming more and more upfront, also in the classical music world. Up until now, I don't see an easy solution. On the one hand, orchestras on tour are depending on airplanes. On the other hand, we bring such a cultural benefit to the people. And so do the birds.
The benefit is very similar as far as people go to what you do with your music, because they bring beauty, they bring wonder. You know, they bring a whole new experience for people to see a small bird that weighs an ounce and to think that it's flown that distance to come down here to Adelaide, and you could say to see me if you like. The same beauty is bought by you flying the same distance to come here for a few days to share your music. And it draws people together across the world, because culturally we are quite different from Indonesia, Japan, Korea, China. But these birds need some of the stopping off points there, just like you need a stop off point in your plane. So we need to make a connection with those people to show them the benefit of caring for their coastline, their environment. So these birds, if they want to stop off to feed, have got somewhere to stop off to feed. And I believe that link with our cultures is an understanding that's not gained in any other way. It connects the people together just like music does. Music speaks every language, so do birds.
What a beautiful way of connecting birds and orchestras. And what a beautiful way of connecting people through nature and music. Talking to Kate has been a real pleasure. It seemed her thoughts easily cross all borders. They fly and stop where they want. If you are in Adelaide and you want to go bird watching, check out Birds SA. Check out their website www.birdssa.asn.au. There you find all the informations about field trips they do, where you can easily join. And what's for sure, the next time when I fly to Australia, before I hop on the plane, I will close one eye and tape it real strong. And then let's see how fresh I will touch ground in Adelaide.
Okay, we're back. Mark. Your chapter's not finished. You went off to China for a year.
Yeah.
So you didn't go home to England after Germany. You continued to after Spain. You continued to another country. So you've done England, Germany, Spain, and now we're China. Tell us about China.
China, yeah. I mean, it was a funny thing because it was a sort of opportunity that came up rather suddenly. And it's just a startup, a new orchestra in Suzhou, which I'd never heard of and subsequently found out. It's a really amazing city.
Right.
It's certainly any Chinese people will tell you it's one of the most beautiful cities in China, amazing old town. And I just got this opportunity and I suddenly thought, well, you know, why not? I mean, there's no reason. I was 45 at the time. I just thought it's a good time to go and have a new adventure and see what it's like to live in another completely different culture.
Completely different.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was something really, that's very challenging. I think many people have asked me what it's like to live there. And I think it's a real country of extremes. You know, the good stuff is really amazing and totally exhilarating because many things are possible. And totally different, kind of intoxicating in a way. But then the bad things are also quite bad. You know, I mean, difficult to sort of live with.
Are we allowed to talk about the bad things?
I don't know. You tell me. I mean, the simple things. There's also, of course, there are the attitudes. You know, from the people and stuff like that. But also, I mean, quite tangible things like the air quality, and which I remember someone telling me before I went there. You know, Suzhou's got quite an air quality problem, and it's a factor. And of course, you think, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you get there, and you start to experience your first weeks living in heavy pollution that we just don't know about.
So you're an expert on measuring pollution levels now with these meters.
Yeah, well, it's amazing because from never actually having thought, I didn't even know what an AQI, you know, an air quality index was.
Oh, it's an air quality index.
Yeah,
right.
And suddenly it becomes a thing you look at every single morning.
Oh my God.
You look at the forecast before the weather, before anything.
Yeah.
Because
really?
It makes a difference to how you're going to feel.
Every day you're thinking about it.
Every day.
You sick from it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. When it's bad, when it gets up to 250, 300, which is... It can be much worse, so that was typically what it could be around winter time.
Right.
Then it really, you basically feel like you've got a hangover the whole time. And it's really, and you start, I started getting rashes. I started to, have problems, obvious problems, breathing and throat and stuff. So it's a big thing. Yeah, yeah.
Is it absolutely something that you think you get used to? Like someone who's lived there all their life, they don't have these rashes or these reactions?
In a way, it's the worrying thing is that when you, and I noticed this when I went away and came back, you know, as I said, I was traveling backwards and forwards, that when you first come back, your body reacts quite strongly. And then it kind of gives up and, you know, and you stop getting these reactions after a while. So you can say you get used to it, but I don't think it's necessarily a good thing, you know.
No. So. And artistically, musically, I mean, you were playing in an orchestra, but you were probably tutoring as well, teaching maybe, or...
Yeah, I mean, I had this
advising?
Sort of, yeah, I had this kind of triple role where I was playing in the orchestra, teaching in theory and sort of consulting to the orchestra because they it was a startup. And although they're very able and super ambitious, there are many sort of, they have some gaps in their knowledge when it comes to cultural management, yeah.
There must have been differences between them and Germany. Germany having such a history, or as we were saying, talking earlier, already with so many traditions that are great but also can be stifling. Did you feel also that there was an openness there that they could... maybe learn faster or they were not constrained with a tradition?
Yeah, yes, I suppose so. I mean, there's a tremendous ability in certain instruments there, you know.
Aha. Uh-huh.
When the string school is, they're very able and technically, you know.
Everybody has to learn the piano, a cello or a violin.
Absolutely.
Right.
I remember one day I went to Chengdu, to go and see the pandas. I was really sort of happy to go and see the pandas. When I went to Chengdu, I got invited to go to meet the trombone professor at the conservatory. And this is a conservatory which has 30,000 students, you know, the Sichuan Conservatory.
30,000.
And then you...
That's amazing.
It's like a whole different level. And this place is enormous,
so
obviously.
If you're teaching there, how many students do you teach?
I mean, I think trombones is like normal because almost no one wants to play the trombone in China. So.
How do they do an orchestra?
But I mean, the funny thing was that they have this huge long road that leads out of the conservatory, which is just full of, I mean, literally hundreds of shops, piano shops, basically. And I happened to be there on the day when they were doing the entrance exams, and there were thousands of people practicing.
Oh, my God.
So it was just, my memory of that day was walking down to get lunch with the professor bought me lunch, and it was an amazing meal. But walking down, just hearing this cacophony of
these thousands of people. So how many practice rooms and things do they have there?
I think actually not that many. I think they somehow...
They're all practicing in the piano shops.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. They just go down the shop and try another piano, you know.
Gosh.
And that was a really bizarre and something that really stuck in my mind, you know.
Mark, Kirsty, I want to talk about Mahler Chamber Orchestra now. and its place in your lives. Why do you not let go of it? Why do you think it will always be there? Why can't you not let go of it?
Well, we all have such close friends here now as well. We've all known each other for so long.
Right.
That's part of it, yeah. You know. And then, yeah, just the energy in the concerts of the orchestra is something very special.
It's addictive.
It is, yeah.
It's a kind of performing that is addictive.
Yeah. I remember actually one person, I was doing another one of the like Q&A sessions that we did yesterday, and someone asked me, I think it was in our academy project, and I actually said to them, yeah, it's like a drug. Yeah, I mean, when you perform in this orchestra,
much better than a drug. Yeah. We'll say that now.
No, and you really feel it when you don't perform for a while, you know, and even in great orchestras, which are wonderful. And,
yeah,
yes.
But there's something very special, and
even
also,
in the rehearsals,
absolutely. And this whole thing of fact, because it's very easy, and I'm sure sometimes you look at like the material that we put out there, and it's family, you know, it's mentioned often. I think this family idea, and it can sound a little bit maybe
cheesy, it's not.
But it's
the
really
real
true.
Deal.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's really true.
And it's funny because we all play in other orchestras, which is another aspect that probably unfortunately won't have time to cover in this podcast. But anyway, we all play in other orchestras in countries like a German orchestra or a Spanish orchestra that also have musicians from all over the world in them as well, because the classical orchestral music community is very international. Mm. But it's still anyway not the same as playing in Mahler Chamber Orchestra that also has musicians really from the entire globe.
Exactly.
Why is it so different?
I guess it's the thing you were saying before, the nomadic
sense
of the orchestra. So it's just something very special.
Yeah, when you're on a project, and this has been said before, but it's really true, when you're on a project, that it's so intense because you're not at home thinking about your bills or thinking about...
you're not going to a dentist appointment.
I mean, I mean, I noticed even with my Sydney Symphony, with my orchestra, on tour, it's a totally different feel as well, you know. But we get to have that the entire time. It is much more intense. Yeah. Everything is much more intense experience. Yes.
We all know that there are big difficulties with touring as well. I mean, it's bloody tiring. It's really stressful. I mean, of course, you shouldn't underestimate that there are sacrifices you make.
Yeah.
But for me, also having a family at home, anyone who's got any roots at home, the one thing that has to count is the music you're making. When I step on stage and I perform, it has to mean something to me. Otherwise, there's no point coming 4,000 kilometers away.
Yeah.
I think there's a tremendous sense of responsibility as well, you know, that because we're an orchestra that we're, you know, as we know, we're self-governing and we have to survive. We only survive through our quality, you know, and being committed to the project. So I think everyone in the orchestra feels a tremendous sense of responsibility.
And all your travels, MCO and all the countries you lived in, but what have you learned the most about stepping into other cultures? What have you learned about traveling around the world? That it's a good thing, or that, contrary to what sometimes you hear in the media, globalization is a negative thing?
I think it's a good thing. I mean, to experience, you know, it is so different still, even though, globalization is happening. It's not the same as even, I remember, you know, going to America 20 years ago and you'd get your, I don't know, Reeboks that you couldn't get anywhere else, whatever. You know, now you can't get everything everywhere. But it's still incredibly different. I mean, when we go to Japan next week, I mean, it's still like landing on another planet.
Exactly.
And I love that.
Yes.
I think one of the main things I learned is that when you go to a different culture, don't expect them to change. You have to change.
Oh,
you know, like
very
when you live
well
somewhere
said.
Else. And it's really true.
Yeah.
And I think the first reaction is, why do they do it like that here? Yeah. Why is this XYZ like this?
And they're probably thinking about you. Why are you doing that?
Well, no, they don't think about it at all.
Right.
But you, that's why you can't expect or try to change anything. You just have to be adaptive and that.
So tolerance and flexibility and understanding that you're not the only culture on the planet.
Yeah, it's a great lesson.
Yeah. It's a great lesson for anyone, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it has, as we've been saying, you know, it has a real influence on the way you make music.
Yes.
And I think actually not only for musicians, I think everyone
in
the world today, everyone should live at least 1 year somewhere else in a different culture. I think it would, you know, solve many things.
Yeah. I feel we are coming towards the end of this podcast somehow, which has been lovely. I've got one last, what do they call it? Spinner, twister, I'm going to throw out in the air. The year 1788 was the year Mozart composed his three last symphonies that we are playing here in Adelaide. This is for you, Kirsty. at the same time that, is it Botany Bay they landed
Botany
on?
Botany Bay, yeah.
And signed a simple document establishing European Australia.
Yes.
Basically at the same time he composed these pieces.
Amazing.
And I couldn't find anything in the Adelaide programme about it.
I hadn't realised that was the year amazing. The symphony started. Wow, yeah.
I only realised by Googling.
Well, it's here.
I mean, it's amazing still how new, you know, our settlement here is as well. You know, when you think my violin was made in 1774, which is before.
Incredible.
Yeah.
How long do you reckon it would have taken Mozart to come over to Australia and perform those symphonies?
Oh, God.
In those
days? At that time with the first fleet and things, I think it was a year on the boat.
Was it a year?
A year. I'm pretty sure. Maybe I'm wrong.
I thought like 3 or 4 months. But anyway, I want to say a huge thank you to both for joining us here for our very first podcast. Thank you, Kirsty Hilton. Thank you, Mark Hampson.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for following our very first Between the Bars podcast. By now, you've digested many stories, probably even too many. But don't forget, we're still learning. It is famously said, it takes a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice to become a professional musician. I say no more. Don't forget, stay connected with Mahler Chamber Orchestra at mahlerchamber.com, where you can find out everything going on and where we are playing in the world. Plus, of course, link to our YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and email accounts. And if you come to one of our concerts, please, please don't be shy. Come say hi backstage afterwards. Next time on Between the Bars, I'm going to talk about breaking legs, climate change, flying big jumbo jets, and of course, music, with one of the world's most talented conductors, Daniel Harding. Between the Bars podcast team is Mark Parker, Matthias Meyer, and me, Yannick Donderlanger. Special thanks to Takt Eins for recording our concerts and to Tim Summers, MCO violinist, for creating Between the Bars intro music. Till next time, from the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, keep listening.
Between the Bars.